Support for this broadcast of Two Rivers 30 Minutes comes in part from a grant from Striffler's Family Funeral Homes.
From TubeCityOnline.com, this is Two Rivers 30 Minutes, a weekly series of interviews with people making news around the McKeesport area. Produced by Tube City Community Media Incorporated, a nonprofit corporation. I'm Jason Toger, the executive director. On this show, we talk one-on-one with elected officials, community leaders, and others who are trying to make a difference in the Monongahela area. And we also take your questions and comments on Facebook and Twitter at Tube City Online.
Boy, there are so many urban legends, lore, myths, folklore. I actually worked for a place where we said we didn't have a written policy manual. Everything was just passed down through folklore and innuendo. And I like to think that in my years living in Western Pennsylvania, I've collected a lot of these, but not as many as author Thomas White. During his day job, he works for Duquesne University as an archivist and curator of special collections, but he's written several books. His first book was called Legends and Lore of Western Pennsylvania, and he's going to be coming to the McKeesport Heritage Center in September to talk about that book. His name is Thomas White. Good morning, Thomas.
Morning. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you for taking some time to talk with us. In reading your Legends and Lore book, which came out back in 2009, and which I think you're going to be speaking to people about at the McKeesport Heritage Center, and we'll give you more details about that talk in just a couple of minutes. I thought I knew a lot of these legends and myths, but I didn't. There's a lot of new information here, including for our audience, especially the people who listen to us on the radio stations in the Mon Valley. There's a lot of these that come out of the McKeesport Monongahela River area, which fascinates me to no end. Where do you find these? Where did you find some of these stories that you're telling?
I've been researching them for a long time. So, you know, I grew up in the area, as I'm sure many of your listeners did. And, you know, growing up, you hear these stories, right? And you hear things that, like the B-25 in the Mon and other urban legends and ghost stories. And I always kind of filed them away in the back of my mind because I was interested in that kind of stuff. But because, you know, it was kind of weird, I guess. You know, I like that kind of those kind of stories. And I became, you know, a professional historian and archivist as my career. And for 6 years, I worked at the Heinz History Center, actually. So when I started working there in 1999, I thought, you know, I heard these stories all my life. Why don't I just look up the real story behind them? You know, and I started doing that. And I also had read a lot of academic folklore and like academic folklore analysis. So what I tried to do is merge academic theories about folklore, real history, and the urban legends and see where they all intersect kind of in the public mind, you know. And so I started gathering and documenting these legends, and I heard so many. In Pennsylvania, really, Western Pennsylvania especially, but Pennsylvania has so many legends. It's unbelievable, the volume of legends and urban legends in the state. And there's many reasons for that. We're kind of at a crossroads historically of many things, and they just tend to thrive here.
How many books have you written now?
I've written 11 books. The most recent was The Witch of the Monongahela, Folk okay. Magic in Early Western Pennsylvania, about the legend of Moll Dairy, the witch from Fayette County, and some other related topics. Yeah.
One of the legends in your book, Legends and Lore of Western Pennsylvania, is about Braddock's Gold. And we've talked on this program. We've had people from the Braddocksfield Historical Society and Fort Necessity and so forth on this program. So we've talked a little bit about the French and Indian War over the years. But I don't know that we ever talked about Braddock's Gold. What is the legend of Braddock's Gold?
So there's a couple different versions of it that float around out there over the years. But the general, the most told one, I guess, is that when Braddock's expedition during the French Indian War, you know, of course, was coming up to displace the French at Fort Duquesne. And as they were getting closer to the fort and they were going to engage in battle, the legend often is that Braddock had the pay chest for his army, which was the largest army in North America at the time, hidden somewhere, so they didn't carry it with them into battle. And often that place is listed, you know, as like some people say the site of Kennywood, some people say Circleville, some people say a variety of spots along the road. And then of course they marched into battle, and Braddock was of course defeated unexpectedly. And when they retreated, they never retrieved the lost treasure, allegedly. And that's the story that's generally told. Now, it's interesting because there's actually documentation that when they got a few miles into the wilderness, Braddock decided not to bring the pay chest with them, and he sent it back to the fort. So there's a record of that. However, They did pay the soldiers, and there's stories of all the, after the battle, the French, especially the Native Americans that were allied with the French, were walking away with gold, you know, and coins that they took off the soldiers. But what I've always found interesting is that various sources point to the idea that it's been said it was between 1,000 and 10,000, what would be, you know, British pounds of money, which would be a lot of money back then.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
And, you know, the interesting thing is, though, that there does seem to be some indication that Braddock had his own money with him, which would have been a trunk that might have been taken, or he may, you know. And so there's a speculation that the gold was hidden somewhere, or somebody's gold from the expedition that they didn't feel comfortable approaching, and they decided to stash it somewhere and get it on the way back. I'm not sure how much money they really would have been carrying into the woods, but you know, there's circumstantial evidence that there might have been something, probably not on the scale that, you know, that the legend talks about, you know. And plus, I always tell people, you know, if somebody found that 100 years ago, I don't know if they'd even tell anybody, and they just slowly spend the money.
Right, know? Right. Well, you mentioned that there might be, you know, if it was found on somebody's property, you know, they might claim that gold was theirs, for instance, and they might have to, or they might have to pay taxes on it. Some of these legends are a little bit too good to be true, right? Braddock, you write, was not really a rich man. So it's not like he was a pirate and they had a pirate ship where they had loot on board.
Yeah, there's a lot of urban legends. That's, you know, that's the interesting thing, is I've explored hundreds of these legends over the years. Is often most legends, there's some truth to them. There are now some I found to be almost entirely true. Mm-hmm. Other ones, you know, there's some truth to them. And when you get into like the supernatural legends, a lot of it's subjective, right? Mm-hmm. Do you have a supernatural experience or not? But even that, often there's cultural things being imprinted on the legend that change over time. It represents fears. And sometimes I always tell people things like ghost stories can be a form of memory or history. Mm-hmm. And often, you know, I often use this example of ghost stories is if you look at, and I've looked at lots of ghost stories from the 1800s in Pennsylvania, especially, you often realize that, you know, probably, and I'm just guesstimating, it's about 60 to 65% of the ghosts are women or Native Americans or immigrants or African Americans. Unless they're a famous person, you almost never see things like dead white Protestant lawyer ghost, you know. But at the same time, if you look at history books from back then, they're the only people mentioned by name, extensively documented.
But the ghosts are kind of these outsiders.
Yeah, so the ghosts are the outsiders, and their story, their often tragedies are retold in the ghost story, and that's how their history survives. And so sometimes, regardless of whether something supernatural is happening or not, the stories serve other purposes.
Let's jump back to Braddock for a minute, because we have a break coming up. We're not so sure that the myth of Braddock, so don't go out there digging holes all over North Huntington Township trying to find Braddock's gold, because it's probably not there. But there was a real conspiracy that I think is pretty well documented, and you documented in your book, Legends and Lore of Western Pennsylvania, and that's Braddock's grave. What happened when they lost the Battle of Braddock at the present-day site of Braddock Borough in North Braddock, and they were going back in retreat back to Cumberland? Braddock died of wounds that he had suffered in the battle. And where did they bury him?
They actually buried him right in the middle of the road, and they rode all the wagons over him. This is what be today roughly Route 40. Now, his actual grave would have been the old Braddock's Road, which is parallel within a few yards of Route 40.
Down near Jamonville. Basically.
Yeah, near Jamonville. Yes, there's a marker there when they reburied him after his body kind of went on tour, which is a whole different story. But basically, they buried him in the road and ran the tracks over because they didn't want anyone digging him up.
And they kind of forgot where he was, too, right?
Yeah. Even George Washington actually oversaw the burial when he couldn't remember where he was. But there's an interesting legend about it. There's this guy from Fayette County named Tom Fawcett, who was this kind of probably a little bit belligerent mountain man who
drunk, I believe, is one way you would say it. Yes.
Yeah. So he had a reputation for years and, you know, as being this kind of rowdy, drunk mountain man. But he had been with the militia that had gone with the Virginia militia that had gone with Braddock. And, you know, the Virginia militia was used to fighting, you know, American Indians in the woods. So they knew, like, when a battle happened, jump behind a tree, don't stand out in the open in a big square, you know. And so when the Virginians did that, Braddock started swinging at them with the flat of his saber, calling them cowards. At one point, he whacked Tom Fawcett's brother, in which case, supposedly, Tom Fawcett turned around and shot Braddock off the horse, was the story. And he was one of the wounds that ended up killing Braddock. And for years, nobody believed him. But when it was time to build the National Road, that no one could find Braddock's body, Tom Fawcett, who was then very old, he supposedly lived to be well over 100, walked over, pointed in 1804, pointed to a spot in the road and said, "He's right here." And they dug it up. And sure enough, there was Braddock's body. And only someone that was there would know where that body was. And for years, people didn't believe him or believe his story. Yet he was the only one that knew where he was buried.
And then Braddock, General Braddock, finally got a proper burial then in Fayette County,
Yes. Yeah.
and not wasn't buried in the middle of the road, buried in a pothole, basically, which is a very Western Pennsylvania story.
Yeah.
Thomas White is our guest. He is an author of 11 books, including his first book, Legends and Lore of Western Pennsylvania. He will be coming to the McKeesport Heritage Center on October 19th to speak about that book. You can get more information at mckeesportheritage.org. We have a break. When we come back, I want to ask you, for our listeners on 88.1 in Bethany, West Virginia, about the judge who was buried on the state line and sold his soul to the devil, and it was not for a golden fiddle, okay?
Sure.
Broadcasting from the Tube City Center for Business and Innovation in downtown McKeesport, this is Two Rivers 30 Minutes. We'll be right back.
Support for this broadcast comes from the City of McKeesport Fair Housing Office. Fair housing is your right, and the Fair Housing Act prohibits discrimination in housing because of race, color, national origin, religion, sex, gender identity, sexual orientation, family status, or disability. That includes renting or buying a home, getting a mortgage, seeking housing assistance, or engaging in other housing-related activities. For more information about Fair Housing Act protections in the city of McKeesport, call 412-675-5020, extension 635.
Welcome back. We're talking about the legends and lore of Western Pennsylvania. Our guest this morning is Thomas White. By profession, he is an archivist and curator of special collections at Duquesne University, but he is also the author of 11 books on legends and lore across Pennsylvania, including one book that is called Legends and Lore of Western Pennsylvania. He'll be coming to McKeesport in October to speak about that at the McKeesport Regional History and Heritage Center. So you recount, and this is one of the many legends in your book, Legends and Lore of Western Pennsylvania, that I had never heard of, and that is Judge Reddick from Beaver County. Judge Reddick was a gambling man, wasn't he?
Yes, he was. And so the story is Judge Reddick, who had kind of earned his reputation in the War of 1812, and he'd done some fighting and been involved in several things. He became a prominent but fair judge in Beaver County, and he had his own racetrack he had built because he loved betting on horses. And so after a while, he would beat everyone. You know, I mean, he was really good at it. He was good at betting. He made a lot of money gambling, you know. And one night he's out there racing his best horse, on his best horse, walking around the track. And lo and behold, previously he had made a crack that he could even beat the devil at a race, which, of course, as you know, how devil tales go, how this is going to work out. One night, late at night, he's out there on his track with his horse, and the devil appears on his horse, and they enter a bet. And of course, the devil offers him a huge amount of gold. Depends on which version of the story you hear. There's more elaborate versions of the story than others. Obviously, a bunch of wealth and you know other things if he can beat the devil at a race. But of course, we know how this also works. If the devil wins, he gets your soul. So Judge Reddick was confident his horse would win. And so he accepts the challenge, and they race late at night under the full moon around the track. And Judge Reddick is winning. They're almost to the finish line. He's ahead. Then the devil's horse turns and spits fire at his horse's face, slows him down, and the devil crosses the line first. The devil basically says, "When you die, I'm going to come to collect your soul." Now, Judge Reddick, being a legal scholar that
he's a lawyer,
himself
yeah,
as,
right.
decided that he was going to find a loophole out of this deal. So he basically had his grave dug on the Western PA or the PA West Virginia border. And so literally he was buried on the line. So half his body was on one side, half his body was on the other. And so when he died, the devil would have to get extradition papers from one state to take his soul. But then he would just roll over on the other side, the devil would need to get them from the other state, and he'd move back to the other side. You know, this is kind of the classic kind of tall tale story of that were common in early America, where Americans are so smart and ingenious, we outsmarted the devil through technicalities. But Judge Reddick is one of these kind of devil tales that it came up early on, where he just kind of outsmarts the devil using legalese and rolling back and forth between on either side of the state. And then, you know, of course, the two states can't agree. Back then, of course, the state wasn't West Virginia; it was Virginia proper.
Uh-huh, sure.
Point. But so they can't agree, and he squeaks by on the technicality.
But there's another lore that the devil finally caught him and turned him into a horse, and this would be in the area of Raccoon Creek State Park, I believe, Hanover Township, Beaver County. That at night you can hear the devil riding Judge Reddick through the, and Judge Reddick is screaming the whole way, something like that.
Yes, yeah, he turns him into a horse and rides him like
in
it's a race
all
through that area, and it's interesting because when they resurveyed the border. The devil got the last laugh because Judge Reddick turned out to be 4 feet inside of Pennsylvania on the new lines. So again, maybe there is still a message there. Were these things written down?
Were these kinds of ghost stories written down, or is this just oral tradition that was passed down for generations?
Some of them were written down in the 1800s. Some started as oral tradition that were passed down. So, you know, these were probably written. I think Judge Reddick appears back fairly far, like maybe, mm-hmm. you know, mid to late 1800s. But some are oral traditions, some are written down. Often eventually they get written down. The thing with folklore and legends is that, you know, even when you write them down, you're kind of capturing a fixed form.
Sure.
And that becomes maybe the standard version. And even I've kind of done this myself by writing down various versions.
Sure.
But even over time, though, people still will tell alternate versions, right? But the great thing with folklore and legends is it's not a straight line. It's a whole bunch of wavy lines going in different directions. And eventually they merge at a point where the story is told. And every person telling the story has their own spin or their own reason for telling it. And so sometimes these old stories come back and can have some kind of, viability in the present.
We haven't even gotten into the B-25 in the Monongahela River, which I think a lot of people are going to be coming to your talk on October 18th, and that's one of the things they're going to want to know about, or October 19th, rather. That's one of the things they're going to want to know about. But we have another break coming up. Before we get to that, I want to jump back to George Washington and back to something you said about writing down these folklore and legends. You talk about the Parson Weems biography of George Washington, which for a lot of people, especially older folks who were in elementary school, maybe 40 or 50 years ago, a lot of people were still reading that Parson Weems history, and a lot of the stories that we think we know about George Washington. George Washington cannot tell a lie. He chopped down the cherry tree with his little hatchet, and he told his father that I'm the one who chopped down the cherry tree, Papa. A lot of these stories that were in the Parson Weems book were fictitious. Is that a nice way to put it?
Oh, yes. Yeah. Many of them were, they certainly would not stand up to any historical scrutiny. And even the ones that aren't really that kind of out there, there's no way to verify whether they really happened.
Let me ask you, because after the break, I'm going to follow up on this with you. What was Parson Weems deliberately lying, or was he just telling a good story?
Probably, he was definitely a storyteller. Mm-hmm. And, you know, again, he was one of those people, I don't know if you've ever, I'm sure everyone knows some people where it's like, there's part of the story is true. There's a piece there that's true. And then they just can't stop themselves from embellishing it and making it sound even better. You know what I mean? Or telling mm-hmm. the version they think best represents what they're trying to get across. And that's part of the fun of working with these legends is sifting through these layers that build up over time and trying to figure out what happened when and where and why certain things stick and other things don't.
Thomas White is a author of 11 books. His first book was called The Legends and Lore of Western Pennsylvania. It's available from the History Press or wherever books are sold. In his professional life, he is a archivist and curator of special collections at the Gumbark Library at Duquesne University. When we come back, let me ask you about this B-25 conspiracy, the bomber that went down in Monongahela River and was never seen again. And what was on board? What was it carrying? Or did it just sink into the muck? Let's if you're okay with that. And I also want to ask you how people can spot. You have a lot of experience as an archivist. How can people spot when someone is just telling a good story or when something is accurate? Okay.
Oh, sure. Sounds good.
From the Tube City Center for Business and Innovation in downtown McKeesport, this is Two Rivers 30 Minutes, and we'll be back in 30 seconds to wrap things up.
Support for this broadcast comes from Striffler's Family Funeral Homes. Since 1866, Striffler's has provided compassionate professional memorial services for families at White Oak, McKeesport, McKeesport, Dravosburg, Portview, and the surrounding areas. Striflers offers comprehensive pre-planning services and aftercare. And through its affiliated company Design Monuments, Striflers also provides permanent markers and memorials crafted in stone, bronze, and other high-quality materials. Learn more at striflers.com or call 412-678-6191.
Back for a few more minutes with Thomas White. He is an author, archivist, and historian. 11 books he has written so far. He'll be coming to the McKeesport Regional History and Heritage Center on Saturday, October 19th. The talk is free. His talk is called The Lost Bomber of the Monongahela and Other Pittsburgh Conspiracies. You can find out more information at McKeesportHeritage.org. And I presume you will have some of your books there available for purchase and for people to get autographs.
Yes, okay. Yes, I'll have some there.
Yeah. So the Lost, and I have a personal connection to this, and that my grandfather worked for the Baltimore and Ohio Railroad and was in the railroad yard, supposedly, on the fateful afternoon, and you can tell the story better than I, that when an Air Force bomber crashed into the Monongahela River. So take us back. What day was this?
Sure, that was January 31st, 1956, and this plane had left Nellis Air Force Base and flew to Tinker Air Force Base in Oklahoma, then to Selfridge in Michigan, where it didn't refuel, and originally had seven people on it, one got off there, and then it was flying to, they always say to Olmsted and Harrisburg, but it was really going to Andrews Air Force Base.
Okay.
And so it ran, at some point when it just got past Pittsburgh, it started to run out of fuel, there must have been a leak or a problem, had to turn around and come back. Couldn't make it to any of the airports, barely cleared the Homestead High-Level Bridge and set down fully intact in the Monongahela River.
Yeah, one of the things that you clarified in your story and in your book was, because I had always heard it was flying from Nevada to the East Coast somewhere, and I couldn't figure out, well, wait, how did it fly, why did it turn around and come the other way and end up in the Monongahela River? But you explained they were turning back, they were going to try to make it, I guess, to Greater Pittsburgh Airport or Allegheny County Airport, and they didn't quite make it.
Yeah, they were going to try to do the big airport first and the Allegheny County one. They decided not to land at any of the closer airports in Westmoreland County, actually, which is also a little bit unusual. But the plane had on it two majors initially, one got off, but a major, two captains, a staff sergeant, a master sergeant with really high security clearance, and an airman. Okay. Second class. Their official purpose was to transport airplane parts.
Okay.
So a lot of high-ranking guys for parts.
So the plane crashes into the Monongahela River intact, more or less, to the point where the occupants are able to climb out onto the tail, and they're rescued
except
by...
Except for two of them drowned. Two of them never got out of the plane. But the other ones got out. They climbed out on the wings, got in the river, which was freezing. They were picked up
by tugboats. January 31st,
picked up by tugboats and various people.
Now, that very night, because after reading your book, I went into the old newspaper archives. That very night, the Pittsburgh police sent their river patrol out. The Coast Guard came. J&L Steel sent a barge. Everybody was out there dragging the river with tow hooks to pull this plane back up. What happened?
Well, ultimately, they would search for 4 weeks and never officially find it. But soon, theories started to come forth that either that night, but probably a night or two later, they had secretly pulled the plane out of the river at the J&L docks, cut the wings off, dropped the wings on one barge, covered it with a tarp, dropped the body on another barge, covered it with a tarp, and took it down over the Emsworth Lock and Dam to the Swickley Coast Guard Station, where it was supposedly put on trucks and taken to the Nike Missile Command Center in Oakdale. But people claim to have seen this pulled out of the river and the work being done at 3 a.m. And people often are very skeptical of that. But I always remind them, this is one of the legends that I think is probably true. Because, a B-25 is 50 feet long, is almost 70-foot wingspan, 13 feet tall with the landing gears up, which the landing gears would have been up. The Mon River in some parts floods at 18 feet. There's spots where it goes down to 20 or 25 feet deep. Closer to the city, it floods at 18 feet. You're not talking about deep water here. And people often misunderstand how the rivers work. And it's shallower near the banks. That's a big, they've never lost anything that large in the river when they've looked for it. They've purposely sunk things like old barges on purpose, but they've never lost anything that big. And it's not, it's about 1/8 of the width of the river.
Mm-hmm.
It shouldn't be hard to find. They should have found it immediately. In fact, 2 years earlier, a DC-10 crashed in the river near McKeesport and they pulled it right out. They mm-hmm. hooked it easily, pulled it out. Got it out of the river immediately. A whole month goes by and they can't find this plane. It can't go past the Emsworth Lock and Dam.
Right.
They had helicopters with Geiger counters. Now, people often think, oh, was there something nuclear on board? But one thing they used to do in the Air Force was put sometimes a very tiny bit of radioactive material in the wingtips to recover planes if they ever sank. And so you could find it easier. So they did that. They searched and searched. And years later, when I worked at the Heinz History Center, we did with a B-25 recovery group, side scan sonar the whole river bottom, put divers in, nothing. That thing is
missing,
apparently
gone.
Not there.
Yeah.
Even though they claim it's still in the river.
Right. And the reports, the official reports have been obtained through Freedom of Information Act requests,
yes.
And they are large sections of them are blacked out to this day, 60 years later, 70 years later.
Yeah, it's almost 70 years later, and there's still big
classified.
Sections that are blocked. The key parts that tell you what happened are still blacked out.
We are just about out of time, and there's a lot more in the book, including a lot of legends about Dead Man's Hollow in McKeesport, the Curry Hollow Tunnel, which is something that I discovered by myself by accident late one night and scared the pants off of me. The murals, the Vanco murals in Millvale, legends about that.
Yes.
Even legends about your own Duquesne University, about
yes.
founded by the Holy Ghost Fathers and apparently has some ghosts of its own, at least some people say. So there's a lot more in the book. But before we let you go, I want to ask you, as an archivist, as a historian, how do we know what to trust? When we go out there and do research and we get a book and it seems to, you know, has all these facts and it maybe even has footnotes in it, how are you skeptical? What makes you skeptical when you're reading someone's narrative and you're like, okay, this is slipping.
I look for these really fine details. You have to, it takes years to train yourself to look for these details. Like for the B-25 example, for example, if I'm interviewing someone, they said, we saw them put scuba divers in the river and they were working on the plane. Well, you can't scuba dive in a river. You have to do hard hat diving, you know? So often it's these little fine details. And, you know, one thing I tell people as an archivist, I also helped run an oral history program out of here too. People often, I always tell people, documents are no more accurate than anything anybody says. They are literally just what people say written down. And I can guarantee you documents are, just because it's written down doesn't mean it's any more accurate. And sometimes the oral accounts are more accurate because they can say things that they can't write down. You really have to be careful. You really got to take the time to know the story. And often what I've found is often it's almost always a mix. You know, there's some parts are true, some parts are added on. And it's really, it's the kind of thing you have to put in the time to sift it apart and find out what's really going on.
Does Occam's Razor apply? I like Occam's Razor, which says that the simplest explanation is usually the best. And the other thing I like is when you hear, there's a saying, when you hear hoofbeats, think horses, not zebras. Like, think of what the
yes.
most likely thing that happened would be. Do those hold true a lot of times?
Usually. I'd say about 85% of the time. But I've seen enough things that turned out to be true that were just weird and should not have happened the way they did, but they're logical the way they unfold, but it just doesn't, you wouldn't expect it to go that way, you know. But often it's because we just don't have all the information and background pieces. You know, if we had all that information, then it would make sense. So, you know, it can be really difficult. And a lot of the time you'll never really know for sure what the real answer is.
Missing Air Force planes, the Kecksburg UFO, mysterious islands that have disappeared in the Pittsburgh area. You'll find out about all of those and more in Legends and Lore of Western Pennsylvania. You can get it from anywhere books are sold. Thomas White is the author. He's the author of 11 books. His most recent is about the witches of Pennsylvania, or the witch of the Monongahela folk magic in early Western Pennsylvania. He will be at the McKeesport Regional History and Heritage Center October 19th at 6 o'clock. McKeesportHeritage.org. Tom, thank you so much for taking a little bit of time to talk with us this morning.
Sure. Thanks for having me on.
And thank all of you for listening this week to Two Rivers 30 Minutes, broadcasting from the Tube City Center for Business and Innovation in downtown McKeesport. So long for now.
You've been listening to Two Rivers 30 Minutes, copyright Tube City Community Media Incorporated. Opinions expressed on this program are not those of Tube City Community Media Incorporated. Listener support makes this program possible. If you'd like to make a tax-deductible contribution, please visit our website at TubeCityOnline.com and click on the donate link. You can also get a free subscription to this program and other podcasts at our website using Apple's iTunes or Stitcher.com. If you've got a question or comment, we hope you'll write to us. Our address is Tube City Community Media Incorporated, P.O. Box 94, McKeesport, PA, 15134. You can email us at TubeCityTiger@gmail.com or call us at area code 412-614-9659.
and you can find us on Facebook and Twitter at Tube City Online.